Welcome into Life, Love, Faith, and Family, a production of the American Association of Christian Counselors. I'm Dr. Tim Clinton.
And I'm Dr. Zach Clinton, and together we're your hosts. Thank you for joining us.
If you enjoyed today's program and you feel called to help us equip the church to provide mental health care and to help those in need, visit our foundation at aaccfoundation.org. That's aaccfoundation.org. Hey, there you're going to find a little bit more about the impact we're having in local communities to strengthen families and individuals. We're on a mission to help equip people everywhere to improve their relationship with God and the ones they love.
We'd love for you to be a part of our family. Let's bring a message of hope and encouragement to today's generations. Your gift ensures that this program and your station remain on the air. And on today's program, my dad, Dr. Tim Clinton, and I have a great guest. So let's get started.
On average, in the United States, over 49,000 people take their lives annually. That's one person committing suicide every 11 minutes. Another sobering stat, suicide is the number two cause of death by children ages 10 to 14 in this country. 10 to 14-year-old children. It's hard to believe, but it's true. We have a crisis in this country that's now become a disaster, but there's hope. As we turn our attention to this new month, September. September is Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month, a time for all of us to have serious conversations. My guest is Rita Schulte. She wrote a book a few years ago about the painful loss of her husband, Mike, to suicide. It's entitled Surviving Suicide Loss, Making Your Way Beyond the Ruins. The conversation, it's intimate, personal, revealing, and ultimately hopeful. Let me also add just a brief kind of warning to our conversation. It's hard at times to listen to conversation around suicide. But let me say this again. It's important. Talking about suicide doesn't encourage someone to do that. It actually is the opposite. It just might save a life. Let's go now to Rita Schulte here on Life, Love, Faith, and Family. Rita, what a delight to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Tim. It's a pleasure.
Rita, as we get started, we're going to talk about Mike. I wanted to just ask you, I mean, how you met, your relationship together, and then maybe a little bit about how things began to spin in a dark direction.
Well, we were high school sweethearts. We met, I was 16 years old, and Mike got into dental school. And we moved down to Richmond, Virginia, and he started his dental practice there. We had two kids. He was very involved in ministry, pro-life ministry, anti-pornography ministry, so we did a lot of that. He preached and taught, led Bible studies. We kind of did everything. Then we moved down to Northern Virginia, Fairfax area, and again, you know, continued all of those ministries. And Mike was like Superman. He was very charismatic, a dynamic personality. He was just an amazing man. Later on in life, he got an airplane and got his pilot's license and was really loving that. So it was great. I mean, we had a really amazing love story, him and I. And all of a sudden, he started becoming increasingly paranoid and depressed and anxious, which was very unlike him. And we started noticing these signs. You know, he thought people were out to get him. People were watching us. People were, you know, following us. We couldn't talk on our cell phones unless we went outside. And things began to just kind of spin out of control. He felt like he didn't want to live anymore. And I mean, it was just beyond belief. Like, if you knew this guy, I mean, like I said, he was Superman. I mean, never had a depressed day in his life. And so, you know, I'm freaking out and trying to, you know, get him help. And so I actually got a hold of the Meyer Institute in Dallas. I got him in there, but he never made it, Tim. He went to a couple of places around here in Northern Virginia. There was no help there. And he just really, I think, believed that nothing was going to help him. I mean, he just got so paranoid. He was sitting in his office one day, and Wilma, his chief assistant, kind of kicked him underneath, and he was working on somebody, and, you know, she's like, Doc, she said, what's the matter? And, you know, he goes, they're coming to get me. And she's like, who's coming to get you? You'll see. So a lot of this was fueled by an article Mike read in a dental journal that came about a guy who was doing Medicaid. And Mike was the only dentist within 200 miles that did it. You know, he did free dental work on everybody. So this particular dentist was being searched out by the FBI, and apparently he had made some fraudulent claims. $300,000 work, and I think there was 10 grand fraudulent claims anyway. This guy got carted off by the FBI and sent to prison for 2 years. And Mike read that, and it just, oh my gosh, he just couldn't get that out of his mind. Now, again, this is a rational human being. He has never displayed anything like this before. And yes, it happened over a number of months. He took my daughter to the Greenbrier that February. He died in November. And he said to Ashley when they were walking through the halls, who was that lady that was talking to you? A lady had come up to Ashley and said, how nice you can do this with your dad. And Ashley said, yeah, it's wonderful. And she said, you know, well, I hope you have a great time. And Mike thought, he told Ashley that the woman was there to watch them, that she was planted there. So this happened many, many times. Things really started going downhill in August. He had actually not shown up for work one day, and Michael and I went to find him, and he actually was in his airplane hangar. The plane had was being worked on, and I knew he was in there. And I mean, I like couldn't even feel my body. I knew he was in there, and he had taken his life. So Mikey goes in, and there's Mike sitting in the car in 104 degree heat. He'd probably been in there for 2 or 3 hours. Sitting in the driver's seat with my picture and his sitting right there and a gun. So, I mean, I'm hysterical, obviously. Finally, long story short, we got him to the hospital. He was fine, totally back to himself. Don't say anything about suicide, Rita. You know, we can't risk the practice, we can't risk my airplane, all of that. So it just got increasingly worse until the last weekend we'd gone to Florida. We had a home in Palm Beach, and we went to Florida with some friends, and Mike was just curled up in a ball half the time. It was bad. So he was supposed to fly to Dallas on Tuesday. He was going to leave Monday to go back. I was going to leave Tuesday. And I talked to him that Monday night. I asked him to please let me know that he was safe when he got there. And Tuesday morning, I started calling him, and I couldn't get a hold of him. So I started to panic. I got to the airport. By then, I was really panicking because there's no answer. He was supposed to show up at a doctor's appointment, and I had called that office, and they told me he had showed up, so I breathed a sigh of relief. I get on the airplane, and I get home. I get in a cab. I drive up the driveway. I get out of the car, and I go into the house. Now I see his car in the garage, so I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, maybe he, you know, took a cab to the airport. But when I walked into the kitchen, I saw all of his stuff there, his Bibles on the counter, his bags. And I walked up stairs, and when I turned the corner, I could see him in the bed, and he had shot himself. So I ran in there. I started just screaming, obviously. I'm just screaming through the hallway. I ran downstairs into the kitchen, and I just kind of collapsed and curled up into a ball. And I called my son. I don't even know how I was able to do that, but they're all screaming, and they told me to, you know, go to the side door, that they were going to call 911. And so that's about all I remember. I remember, you know, like kind of curling up in a ball by the side door. And I remember the police coming in, and that was about it.
Rita, I rarely at loss for words, but in this moment, I just feel, again, a sense of grief for you. I know it's been a long time, but as you recall those details, it's stunning. I think it grips all of us, because that's not the way life's supposed to be. Life's supposed to be about joy and love and happiness. And, you know, the mind can be a very free, beautiful, creative place, or it can become a very dark, turbulent place. And when it gets dark and there's that word rumination, when people start ruminating over something and they can't shut it off, it's that peace that wakes them up at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And I know we're talking a little bit here about mental health related themes, but it can be a relationship breakup. This can be acute. This can be chronic. There's just so many factors that fuel into it. But the one thing that seems to be consistent, Rita, is they've lost their sense of hope. There's a despair that kicks in. I've often heard people say this, people who are suicidal don't hate life. They hate life the way it is, and they don't think it's ever going to change. Is that right?
Yeah, and they also have a tremendous sense of self-loathing. You know, Dr. Tom Joyner's model, and he's a prominent suicidologist, along with David Jobes, who's done the CAMS model. And Tom was gracious enough to endorse my book, but his model suggests a couple different things. You know, why would somebody desire to die by suicide? And the answer is, a sense of fearlessness, and that's a whole, you know, another topic, but this idea of a perceived sense of burdensomeness and a thwarted sense of belonging. So these folks can, you know, depending on what it is that's, you know, this loss that's driving it, they can actually loathe themselves. So they actually believe they're doing their loved one a favor by taking their own lives.
I want to go to the days and the weeks after the loss of Mike and what started happening with you. Can you take us into what you experienced?
Well, it was like a bomb went off in my life, and everything you believe comes into question. I mean, I was decimated. I was non-functional, basically, for the first few months. The only way I felt like I was alive, Tim, was just getting in the shower and feeling the water beating against my flesh, right? Wow. And there was a pivotal moment for me about 4 or 5 months in, when I was at my daughter's, and they were watching a little cartoon. My grandbabies were watching a cartoon, and so there was a Scottish accent. It was Brave, the little cartoon. And I got up because Mike and I had just had such an amazing trip to Scotland that summer. And I couldn't watch it, and I got up and I just passed out. And, you know, my son-in-law took me upstairs, they put me in the bed. And later, Ashley, my daughter, came in, and Ashley's, you know, like her dad, very strong. She looked in my eyes and she started to cry, and she's like, "Mom, please try." And that moment, I realized I had to live, right? I had to go on because I had them and I had a couple of grandbabies. And so that was a real shift for me. In the beginning, I think I stayed alive for them. But as time went on, as years went on, and I gained my footing, I started to believe that God had a plan and purpose for my life in this. And I've always believed that God is telling the ultimate story of redemption through Christ. And if that's true, then everything in my story has to fit in the larger story. And hope tells me there's a bigger picture, one that I couldn't fully understand or even see, but it's being told nonetheless. And so if I believed that, I knew I had to go on and finish the work that God called me to do. And that's the journey that I've been on. But it was, the first couple years were pretty dark for me. I experienced panic attacks, a lot of flashbacks. You know, as I told you, I curled up in a ball after I ran down the stairs screaming. And, you know, we know as therapists that those patterns, right, with traumatic memories, right, get encoded in the brain and in the body, sometimes without the person realizing it. And so what started happening for me for a couple of years was that anytime I would be triggered, I would just curl up in a ball. I didn't even realize I was doing it at first. But those memories had been encoded in my brain because that's what I did that first night. And any time a trigger would come, that was my behavioral pattern. And so, you know, I worked with my therapist. You know, obviously that's a big thing for me now as I counsel folks, to intercede into that pattern and, you know, help a person come out of that shutdown state. So whatever a person is feeling is, you know, we want to normalize that, right? Whether it's high activation and the post-traumatic stress that we are experiencing with the flashbacks and the panic and the terror, or whether it's the shutdown state, like I would also do.
I was prepping and reading through the story and realized, Rita, that one of the big pieces for you was trying to ask and answer the question, why? It's like, why God? Why us? Why now? Why this? Why me? You know, a few years ago, Dr. Dobson wrote a book called When God Doesn't Make Sense. I remember making my way through it, trying to understand even some of my own journey. But Rita, that's a tough piece to get through, isn't it? And there was a place for you where you finally came to a moment. I know the stages of grief where working your way through something like this, the Kubler-Ross stages become significant. A lot of people talk about everything from that shock piece up front, denial, to anger, bargaining, acceptance. What's amazing to me, Rita, is as you're dealing with grief and loss, they can come in waves, and it can be all over the place. There isn't any specific flow, really. It's unique to you as a person, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you can be up, down, all around, twisted up into a pretzel. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that's been one of the big things that were misconceptions about her theory. If you read some of her later work, and David Kessler, he co-authored some books with her, it's not supposed to be a linear thing. So I think people just need to know that, that wherever you are, you know, one of the biggest things I want to do with folks is to normalize whatever their experience is, right? And so I also take a very strengths-based approach to that. So I'm always looking for what's right with the client, not what's wrong with them. Oh, you're doing the stages wrong. No, that's not it at all, right? We want to tap into their strengths and their potential for resiliency, and we want to normalize whatever their experiences is, because it's all normal.
Let me put something down here real quick. There's hope. You don't have to live in this broken, dark world. I was excited and encouraged by the new national three-digit telephone number, Rita, 988. That's the new suicide prevention hotline, if you will. There's hope 24/7. It's free. It's confidential for people who are in a suicidal crisis or emotional distress. I think the Lifeline actually helps thousands of people overcome crisis situations every day. Just your thoughts, Rita, on what people should do if they're worried about someone who is threatening to take their life.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Tim. Get your loved one help. I mean, I took Mike to the ER, and, you know, that was all I knew to do at that moment, because he had been locked up in an airplane hangar for 3 hours, right, in the heat. So whatever you have to do, you're going to do that. And then, you know, a team of professionals can help you lay out a game plan, right, to treat your loved one.
Rita, we're fighting time, and I've got two more questions for you that I'd really love for you to address. One is, for someone listening right now who's trying to create a new life beyond that loss, what's one or two, three key nuggets you could give to them that would speak into their heart right now?
Yeah, what do they need? What did I need? I think it's to experience a different reality apart from the hell they're living in. How do we help make that happen? I think it's by encouraging them to risk. See, they need more than an intellectual knowing that life can be different or better. They need an experiential knowing of that. Because what do we know about new experiences? They rewire neural networks. They create new thought patterns. They bring new perspectives. In short, they foster post-traumatic growth. The reality that folks are living in after they're decimated by a loss like this is really only a small way of looking at reality. They don't see that now. I didn't see that now. I could have cared less about post-traumatic growth. I just wanted Mike back. But we are capable of experiencing a different reality. It just takes time, and it's going to look different for each person. For me, in the early stages, as I said, it was my new grandbabies and my children. So that's a big piece. I was, you know, I had people walking alongside of me who pushed me a little bit to take some risks, join a group. I was in three groups. You know, go back to church. Even the smallest things are going to enlarge your world, so that you can begin to breathe around this massive hole that's in your heart.
What lessons did you learn about God? I know you were angry with him. You were extremely disappointed and discouraged, lost. What do you see now looking back and as you look inside and look to the road forward?
Well, I think I've grown a lot, Tim. I mean, Mike was, you know, I mean, we kind of both said we made idols of each other. And because he was Superman, I relied on him a lot. You know, he kind of did it all. And when he was gone, I had to start doing it myself. And I had to, I don't mean my relationship with God, because I was always close to the Lord, but I had so many things nailed down about who God was. And that is such an important part of this whole thing, is concept of God for a believer. Because, you know, all the tacit assumptions we hold about life, God, and the world around us get challenged by a loss of this magnitude. And doubts about God and his goodness are certainly a big part of that. And I had to consider that if God was good, he wasn't out to break me. He was out to break my confidence in all the ways I'd managed to try to, you know, make my life work apart from him. And loss was simply the vehicle that he used to get my attention. I just feel like we have to decide some things about the heart of God, because every loss that we have moving forward, every trial that we have moving forward, will stir seeds of doubt about the goodness of God unless we do that work.
I love Psalm 46 that reminds us when we face difficult times and trouble in our lives that he is in the midst of it.
Amen.
And when you can't, as Spurgeon said, when you can't feel his hand, you can always trust his heart.
It's so beautiful, difficult.
But I believe there are times when God weeps with us in our brokenness. He hates the pain and brokenness of this world. But as Jesus said, be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Reed, I wanted to, in closing, some are listening right now and they have a loved one or they know someone, and they often struggle with what to say when they don't know what to do. Any words of wisdom on how to just care for someone who's living in that pain?
Yes, Tim, I think the biggest thing is just offer your presence, your attuned and compassionate presence. Don't try to fix them. We don't need to be fixed. We just need to feel presence, both of the Lord and both from the people that love us. And that can mean just sitting, listening, asking, what is it you need right now? Do you need to talk? Do you need to be still? I love you. I'm here for you. And I'm praying.
Rita, it's been a real privilege to spend some time with you. As a matter of fact, I was sitting here thinking, we need to have you back. There's so much more to talk about. But if people want to learn more about you and your ministry, where could they go?
Best place is my website, ritaschulte.com. But I have a counseling practice, and everything is pretty much on my website if people want to connect.
Thank you, Rita. I so appreciate your strength and honesty. And I hope you know your message today is going to help a lot of people who have experienced what you've experienced, the loss of a loved one to suicide. Hey, did you know that today, September 10th, is World Suicide Prevention Day? And for our listeners out there, remember, September is Suicide Prevention Month. And if you or somebody you love is in a crisis, get to your local emergency room. Call a pastor, a counselor, or don't hesitate to call 988. That's 988, the Suicide Crisis Lifeline. Confidential support, it's available 24/7, or you can go up online and visit 988lifeline.org. That's 988lifeline.org. This day focuses on international attention on preventing suicide. Remember, asking a person if they're thinking about suicide or if they're in trouble doesn't mean that you're going to encourage them to take that action. It can actually have the opposite effect. Asking for help is hard, but finding help shouldn't be. On behalf of my son and co-host, Dr. Zach Clinton, I'm Dr. Tim Clinton, president of the American Association of Christian Counselors. God bless you. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Life, Love, Faith, and Family, a production of the American Association of Christian Counselors. If you enjoyed today's broadcast and want to help equip the church to provide Christian mental health care, visit aaccfoundation.org. Your donation ensures this program and your station stay on the air. On behalf of our co-hosts, Dr. Tim Clinton and his son, Zach, this is Jim Kress. We look forward to having you with us again next time. May God bless you.
Hey, everybody, this is Dr. Zach Clinton, licensed counselor from the American Association of Christian Counselors, with your Mental Health Minute. Trust is like glass. Once broken, it can be rebuilt, but it takes time, truth, and tenderness. Rebuilding trust, especially after betrayal, is one of the hardest emotional tasks. Psalm 34:18 says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those crushed in spirit." Clinically, trust restoration follows a pattern: honesty, consistency, empathy, and accountability. But it also requires mutual participation. Forgiveness can be instant, but trust is earned. So don't rush what God designed to be rebuilt slowly. Give space for evidence and not just promises. If you're in the process of rebuilding trust, identify one clear, healthy boundary and one way to communicate your needs with clarity and grace this week. This has been your Mental Health Minute with Dr. Zach Clinton. For more information, visit aacc.net.
Asking for help is hard. Finding help shouldn't be. At Christian Care Connect, our mission is to connect those seeking help with a provider who offers the faith-based care they need. At CCC, we offer free mental health assessments for the user to help gauge their psychological and emotional well-being, as well as free self-help blog resources to help educate readers on topics such as depression, anxiety, and more. Christian Care Connect bridges the gap between those seeking help and the caregivers offering it, fostering connections rooted in clinical excellence. If you're looking for help, it's closer than you think. And if you're a provider who's ready to offer help, this site is for you too. Visit ChristianCareConnect.com to find the help you need or get listed as a provider. That's ChristianCareConnect.com.